think we're ready to kick off this session. Today's webcast focuses on the special challenge faced by estuaries that receive freshwater flow from watersheds of often large river systems touching multiple political jurisdictions in a mixing zone with saltwater. EPA established the National Estuary Program to promote comprehensive planning, collaborative problem solving, and technical input, and public involvement to restore these special areas. In Long Island Sound, the National Estuary Program's comprehensive plan identified a disturbing problem in the sound. It suffered from persistent low dissolved oxygen and hypoxic conditions, as well as pathogen and toxic contamination. Long-term studies and a total maximum daily load study on the sound recommended a large reductions in nitrogen loads from the human sources to the sound by 2014 to address this problem. Many of our listeners are, I'm sure, very interested in how pollutant reductions can be implemented from an area of this scale involving different states and using a mix of approaches, both regulatory and incentive-based. Today we will hear the details of this story and some of the innovative approaches such as pollutant reduction credit trading used to restore the Sound's water quality. We have three speakers today. Darryl Brown, the chief of EPA's Coastal Management Branch, will set the context of the National Estuary Program and the Comprehensive Management Plan to start off. Next, Mark Tedesco will outline water quality studies and the TMDL implementation in Long Island Sound. Mark is the director of U.S. EPA's Long Island Sound office and is speaking to us from Connecticut. Finally, we will hear from Gary Johnson, a senior environmental engineer at Connecticut's Department of Environmental Protection. Gary will speak in depth about working with the state's permitting program for treatment plants and on trading pollutant reduction credits. With that, I'll hand you over to Mr. Darryl Brown. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. This is Darryl Brown, and I'll be starting on slide number 3. I'm very pleased to be here today because 2007 marks the 20th anniversary of the National Estuary Program. So we celebrate a milestone, and we're glad to be here on this presentation today. I know we have some folks from the interior portion of the country, so maybe a little definition of what an estuary is. An estuary is a partially enclosed body of water formed where fresh water meets the salt water, where the rivers and streams flow into the ocean, mixing with the seawater. The estuaries themselves and the land surrounding the estuaries are places of transition from land to sea and from fresh water to salt water. And although estuaries are influenced by the tides, the estuaries are largely protected from the full force of ocean waves and winds and storms by reefs or barrier islands, fingers of land, or mud or sand that define an estuary's coastal boundary. And estuaries come in all shapes and sizes, and they're called by many different names: bays, lagoons, harbors, inlets, and sounds. So why are estuaries significant? Estuaries are important for marine and human life. The tidal sheltered waters of estuaries support unique communities of plants and animals that live at the margin of the sea. Examples include the horseshoe crabs in Delaware Bay, the ospreys, manatees, mangroves, and seagrasses. There are hundreds of marine organisms, including most commercially valuable fish and shellfish species, such as scallops and shrimp and salmon, depend on estuaries at some point in their life. The wetland and aquatic vegetation in and around estuaries provide habitat for marine life and protect water quality by filtering out the dirt and pollution and a lot of the upstream crud that we get from upstream areas. Because of our love and dependence on the water, more than half of the nation's population lives within 100 miles of the coast, including the shores of estuaries. Coastal counties are growing about 3 times faster than counties elsewhere in the country. And unfortunately, this love of our estuaries and the increasing concentration of people is upsetting the natural balance of estuaries and threatens their health. In 1987, Congress, realizing this unique stress on estuary areas, developed the National Estuary Program as a way to identify, restore, and protect nationally significant estuaries in the United States. Unlike traditional regulatory approaches, the NEP targets a broad range of issues and encourages communities to develop solutions to these issues. I'll now turn to slide number 2, where we're focusing on some of the four cornerstones of the National Estuary Program. First of all, the first focus is focusing on the ecosystem itself. Because environmental problems do not conform to political jurisdictions, the NEPs define their management areas according to watershed boundaries and the ecosystems within them. And focusing on these hydrologically defined geographic areas helps the NEPs achieve an effective mix of dealing with point source and non-point source problems. The second cornerstone is the integration of good science with sound decision-making, where decision-making needs to be based on the best information and science that is available. Sound science provides objective information that informs debate and produces data on the status and trends of an estuary and helps furnish a basis for policies and programmatic decisions. The third cornerstone is what we call collaborative problem solving, and that as an environmental management approach, collaboration involves creating a shared vision and joint strategies to address the concerns that go beyond any particular interest or stakeholder. By ensuring that all stakeholders are responsible for and interested in the management and use of an estuary, the NEPs have achieved some successful collaboration. These decisions are made through a governance structure that varies by NEP. There are 28 NEPs around the country, and many of them have different governance structures. The fourth cornerstone is involving the public. The NEPs are guided by the principle that stakeholders in the watershed ought to have a meaningful role in shaping the program and substantive opportunities to participate in these activities. So the NEPs strive to facilitate a constructive dialogue in which there's a range of stakeholders in the watershed have the opportunity to address some of the issues and arrive at the solutions in the estuary. I'll now turn to slide number 5, which describes kind of the structural formation of an NEP. The NEP encourages local communities to take responsibility for managing their estuaries. A governor of a state nominates an estuary for inclusion in the NEP, and once accepted, they develop a management plan to address these priority areas. Each CCMP contains actions that are designed to protect the estuary and the resources, and many of those involve Clean Water Act activities, such as TMDL activities. Once EPA approves the CCMP, then the partners are go about implementing the management actions within the management plan itself. Moving on to slide number 6, you can see that there are 28 estuaries in the country representing 19 states and Puerto Rico around the country. You can also see there in the color dots that the year that they have come into existence or were the first end of the program. All 28 of the management programs, the estuary programs, have approved management plans by EPA and are at the, some of them are several years into the implementation stage. Moving on to slide number 7, I won't dwell on this, just that it's another way of representing that the ecosystem is the focus of the estuary program activities. It's a community-based program with a number of different stakeholders involved, from federal agencies down to state and local governments and the affected user groups within the communities. Slide number 8, there was an independent study led by Mark Schneider that was published an article in January of 2003, their team compared those estuaries that include NEPs with those areas, those estuary areas that do not have an NEP, and found that the networks in the NEP areas were a much richer and much more robust network and opportunity and decision-making body than those areas where there was no national estuary program. You can see some of the main points that they raised there, including the number of spanning levels of government, integrating experts, and so forth. Turning to slide number 9, the NEPs are making a difference. There is a myriad examples of how NEPs are making a difference. You can see a few of them up there, from restoring and protecting habitat, working to deal with polluted runoff, working on pathogen issues, dealing with sewage issues, both from sewage treatment plants as well as septic systems. But also the number of NEPs have very active and involved education outreach programs where they encourage public involvement. Two specific examples of, I'll turn to slide number 10 now, two very specific examples of how measures of success for the National Estuary Programs. Since 2000, the NEPs have restored a significant number of acres of habitat around the country, over 1 million acres. Now, one thing to point out here, this is not just the NEPs. We celebrate the partnership that an NEP is, so many of these acres can only be done in collaboration with a number of other state and local partners. The second point there is that the NEPs have been highly successful in return on investment, or in using the federal dollars that the estuary programs receive to partner with state and local governments and also private funding. So a couple measures of success there. Moving on to slide number 11, and some of the next few slides will focus on some of the lessons learned from the National Estuary Program. But let me begin that transition with one talking about the leveraging of funds through the NEPs and how that's helped out. One of the things that the NEPs have learned is that they need to focus on their mission and to develop a strategic approach to achieving that mission. And that includes financial planning. A number of NEPs have gone through a training program to move from that develops a strategic fundraising approach that has been quite valuable for the National Estuary Programs in moving from an ad hoc approach to a more strategic approach. This helps them diversify funding in kind of years where there may be some funding that is lacking at the state or federal or local level. That diversity of funding certainly helps buffer some of those tough times. But it also, one of the things that we've learned is that this building of the partnerships and the public support necessary for the leveraging takes a significant amount of time and effort. So it's one of the things that the NEPs have learned over the years, of how much effort goes into this. Moving into slide number 12 and some of the other NEP lessons learned, collectively we've tried to identify what makes an NEP successful and some of the key lessons that we could learn from NEPs that are transferable to other watershed groups around the country, whether or not they're, you know, saltwater in the system or not. Some of these more generic lessons learned. The first thing that one of the lessons learned is that the community-based resource management can achieve results. We've had, and I just gave the example there of 1 million acres of habitat protected or restored, and this is all happening at the local level. This community-based group is the impetus for restoring and protecting those estuaries. The second point is that, and probably an obvious one, is that it's important to set measurable environmental goals and also indicators. You know, what are we trying to achieve out there? Many times we take a look at the outputs instead of the outcomes, but what is the ultimate environmental goal, and what are those mechanisms that can help us identify those environmental goals and relate those goals to the public in an easily understandable way. The only way that we're going to know whether we measure progress is point number three there, and that is looking at we need to make sure that we have some sort of environmental and programmatic monitoring system in place that can help us measure those goals or progress to those goals. So the monitoring is critical, and the NEPs have accomplished that in a number of different ways, from their own monitoring programs and internal processes through collaboration with state and federal monitoring activities. Turning to slide number 13 and continuing these NEP lessons learned, we've identified, even though each estuary program is different and unique, there are a number of common environmental problems and challenges facing the estuaries around the country, the NEPs in particular, dealing with excess nutrients, pathogens, toxic chemicals, habitat loss and degradation, introduced species, natural flow alterations or regime changes there. And an emerging issue that's coming to the forefront now is identifying these personal care products and emerging contaminants. So one of the values of the National Estuary Program is being able to share those common problems and challenges and collectively looking at solutions to those problems that can be transferred from one watershed to the next. And that kind of covers point number five, too, is addressing these emerging issues. 5 years ago, aquatic invasive species was just starting to, you know, about 5 or 10 years ago, it was just starting to be an issue. But the more we look into it, every estuary program that we're working with is facing problems with introduced species. And this new problem with new identified problem with personal care products, emerging contaminants, is another one of those issues that the NEPs are helping to address. Climate change and potential sea level rise is another issue that a number of NEPs are starting to take a pretty serious look at, so it's another emerging issue. And the last point there, number six, I've already covered that, about the sustainable levels of funding are critical for achieving success. Moving on to slide number 14, the whole foundation of the National Estuary Program is based on partnerships. Partnerships from the federal government's funding and support and training and assistance there down through state and local partners, industry concerns, community groups, a variety of partnerships are key in achieving success in the National Estuary Program. One resource document, I'll move on to slide number 15. One resource document that if you're not familiar with it, it would be the Community-Based Watershed Management Lessons from the National Estuary Program, the document that we put out a couple of years ago that talks about, even though it's taking lessons from the National Estuary Program, it has lessons that can be applied to other watershed groups throughout the country, talking about, you know, governance structures, informing and involving people, collaboration, and science. There's a number of different points there and specific examples from a number of estuary programs around the country. Moving on to slide number 16 and kind of starting the transition into the bulk of today's presentation on TMDLs, I'm sure that most of you are aware of what a TMDL is, but it's the amount of pollutant that a water body can receive and still meet water quality standards, and it includes the point sources and non-point sources, the load allocation for a water body. In this case, we're looking at an estuary itself. We're looking at ways of trying to address TMDLs in a National Estuary Program context. There are a number of NEPs around the country of the 28 programs. The majority of those programs are engaged in TMDL activities in some way or another. some of them just from the planning process, identifying impaired water bodies. And then there's the example we're here today, you know, to the Long Island Sound Program, where they're actively involved with the development of the TMDL and the actual implementation of the TMDL. So the NEPs are taking a number of different approaches there and strategies. Moving on to slide number 17, the nexus for NEPs and TMDLs, the NEPs have developed a number of strategies to attain or maintain water quality, and a number of them are using TMDLs in this context. For example, in Morro Bay, Morro Bay, California, kind of the central California coast, is a local watershed organization that's looking at improving the water quality in Morro Bay. And the CCMP, or the management plan for Morro Bay, is used both as a data source as well as the implementation plan for the TMDL that's being developed in Morro Bay. The monitoring program for Morro Bay has informed the 303D listing process, and it's one of the primary sources for assessing the progress towards implementation. Moving on to slide number 18, TMDLs, developing TMDLs in coastal waters presents a number of challenges. First of all, they contain large watersheds. If you include the extra watershed for the Mississippi River Basin for the Barataria program, it includes 33 different states in the Mississippi River Basin. But many of these estuary programs involve large water bodies where they're receiving waters for literally hundreds and maybe thousands of upstream miles of waters coming down. Many of the estuary programs are multi-jurisdictional in that they cover a number of either local or county, and in some cases they cross state boundaries. Estuaries, by their very nature, as a mixing zone for fresh and salt water, are very complex systems. You have to deal with tides and stratified conditions, salt water wedges, different sediment regimes, and seasonality is also critical in there. There's complex pollutants and ecosystem pathways, both pathways coming downstream, but there's also an oceanic input for dealing with TMDLs, including, for example, mercury. There's an oceanic component for mercury that has to be taken into account. There's different schedules and priorities, and there's a number of different water quality standards and data and methodologies involved, especially in some of these bi-state or tri-state programs. The Delaware Estuary Program involves Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, so they have a particularly tough problem also. Moving on to the last slide, number 19, before we open it up for some questions. Another example there of some of the lessons that have been learned from the National Estuary Program, in that the National Estuary Program is a watershed approach that's used in a saltwater estuarine type environment, but they're really no different than some of the lessons learned from other programs in the critical nature of monitoring and data collection, looking at data and model development, trying to provide efficient TMDL calculations and consolidating some of that information. But it's also, you know, what we've learned in the National Estuary Program is that it takes time to develop and implement these plans and to achieve environmental progress, but it's critical that the public is involved early and often in these, and that there's, you know, that as we've shown in the National Estuary Program, there is some light at the end of the tunnel. There has been success in a number of these areas and programs, and we think that some of that success can be transferred to other areas. We'll now open it up to questions.
Thanks, Darrell. We're going to pause here briefly to take some questions, and I'm just going to remind you that you can submit your questions online. So first of all, I'm going to ask a question that we received online from Tom in Media, Pennsylvania. He asks, can you please define a CCMP and how does it affect the implementation of TMDLs?
I'm sorry, Tom, if I glossed over that. A CCMP is a Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan. It's one of those acronyms or names that Congress laid on us, so we affectionately call it the CCMP. Sorry about that. And then the in terms of how does it affect implementation of a TMDL, it depends on what's included in the management plan itself and how specific that management plan might be. Some management plans are extremely specific in terms of identifying listed waters or problem pollutants or priority pollutants and looking, and there's specific activities within the management plan, the CCMP, that say how that plan is going to be addressed. Other CCMPs are more general in that they just identify perhaps a resource to be protected, such as seagrass beds, and there has to be a mechanism for looking at, for example, Tampa Bay has a nitrogen management plan, which is addressing seagrass restoration ultimately. So they're looking at controlling nitrogen through a quasi-TMDL throughout the watershed and looking at nitrogen reduction. So it varies by NEP.
Okay, thanks, Daryl. We have another question online from Susan from the District of Columbia. She asks about how do NEP stakeholders coordinate with watershed management and planning groups or third-party folks that develop third-party TMDLs. She states that she thinks that probably some of the goals and the objectives of these CCMPs would probably overlap with watershed management groups or plans.
Good question, Susan. And I think that in many cases, the NEP is the local watershed management group or activity there. So in many cases, the NEP or the stakeholders would already be involved with the coordination and activities within that watershed group. For those areas where it may be a different entity, then through the NEP process, there's a science and technical advisory committee, and there's oftentimes a citizens advisory committee where those groups can become involved with the coordination activities with watershed management.
Thanks, Daryl. Since we're on track, we'll take one more online phone question. One more online question, and then we'll open the phone lines. Jean from Edgemont, Pennsylvania asks, we are concerned about the setting of realistic environmental goals that are attainable. What steps can be taken to assure that realistic goals are set?
That's a tough question, Jean, because that kind of gets at the heart and soul of what an NEP is all about and any local watershed group, is that the ecosystem is the focus. The ecosystem is the reason that many of these groups exist, and people concerned about the degradation that may be occurring in an estuary or a lake or whatever that might be, that is the focus, and it's up to that group collectively within the NEP context to set reasonable environmental goals or realistic goals. Oftentimes those goals may be many years out, and so typically the NEP will develop intermediate goals so that they can identify progress and do what's called an iterative management process where they periodically evaluate their success and how well they're doing and then make changes as necessary, or as new scientific information comes in, applying that new science to what may or may not need to be done. But I think it's the constant process of meeting together that the folks evaluate they set their goals and they determine how realistic some of those goals might be.
Thanks, Daryl. Now we're going to open the phone lines. I'm going to remind you that anyone that wants to ask Over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Any questions?
This is Sue Brower. I work in Region 5, and I work in the Waste, Pesticides, and Toxics Division, but I work with staff in the Great Lakes National Program Office on lakewide management plans, and those are comparable to the CCMPs in the National Estuary Program. I was wondering what the geographic extent of the TMDL is for the where there is one in the National Estuary Program. Does it extend out to ocean waters? And if so, how far?
The geographic extent is determined by the listed water itself. There are very few offshore boundaries for the TMDLs that I'm aware of, other than Long Island Sound. There is for example, a trash TMDL in Santa Monica that has been developed, dealing with trash as it flows out through the river systems and contaminates some of the beaches and some of the oceanic areas there, or the more coastal areas, actually. But most of the TMDLs that I'm aware of are kind of contained within the estuary itself.
Any other questions?
Hi, this is Dr. Winslow from Rutgers University in New Jersey. The NEP is a successful program, thank you. And it seems to be most successful in coping with problems that have already arisen. The problem has to arise, and then we see the problem, it's fairly obvious, and we try to cope with it. And we all know how difficult it is and expensive to try to cope with problems after the fact. The pharmaceuticals and personal care products, for example, is a very good one. I mean, we knew 10 years ago that this was going to be a problem. We could see what was going through our sewage treatment plant. But it's only when we find fish with lesions and amphibian decline that we muster our resources and try to cope with the problem. And you talk about restoration. Again, that's after the fact. How can we make NEST and other collaborative programs more proactive?
That's a tough one, because I think, you know, by its nature, you know, we get the resources and the time and attention when there is a problem, and it's hard to take a 10 or 20 or 100 year outlook on some of these activities. Maybe one of the ways and I don't really have a lot of good examples there, but maybe one example would be the Puget Sound program, which is in collaboration with the state of Washington and the University of Washington, has developed a report on how to deal with global climate change and sea level rise. And they have taken a look at, and you know, even though that may be a problem that was long ago and we're able to forecast it, many of the impacts have not been seen yet, if we do indeed have sea level rise. But they are trying to take a look at this proactively and address some of the environmental concerns. But it's just a tough problem in garnering the resources and attention until we have a problem. I think that's just part of our human nature, unfortunately.
Thank you. Excellent questions. Our next speaker is now Mark Tedesco. He is from the EPA Long Island Sound office. Mark? You may have to... Mark? Give me one moment, Mark. Let me do my muting, everybody, and then you'll do your thing. So hold on one second. Mark, can you speak now, sir? Press your magic buttons. Mark?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Good morning for those of you out in the West Coast still. Thanks, Al, for that background on the estuary program. I'm going to talk a little bit in more detail about an approach we've taken in the Long Island Sound study In both the development and implementation. I'm really going to focus mostly on implementation of a TMDL that we developed to achieve water quality standards for dissolved oxygen in Long Island Sound. Let's go to slide number 22. What I'm going to do is walk you through four topics. The first is just to provide some background on the water quality status and trends in Long Island Sound. Again, I'm going to focus on eutrophication issues. I'm going to talk a little bit about the development of a TMDL, total maximum daily load, for the control of nitrogen to address the problem of low dissolved oxygen in Long Island Sound. I'm going to talk about the implementation approach to that TMDL through the use of watershed permits and trading. And I'm going to talk a little bit about progress, what we've been able to achieve in terms of nitrogen control and in terms of the response of the system in dissolved oxygen. Let's go on to slide 23. Daryl really has already explained this. The Long Island Sound Study is one of 28 national estuary programs, and we function very similarly to the other programs. We have two states that participate, so the main sponsors in our case are the Environmental Protection Agency as well as the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. But as with other programs, we have many other stakeholders that participate in the program. Let's go to slide number 24. This is a map of Long Island Sound. You can see Long Island to the bottom, Connecticut would be to the north, Westchester County and New York City to the west. The colored contours represent different concentrations of dissolved oxygen. This is from water quality surveys that were conducted the first week in August this past summer. The black and red colored areas in Long Island Sound are concentrations of less than 2 milligrams per liter. That would be the most severe concentrations that would result in acute effects. Again, these are bottom water concentrations. You can see little numbers throughout. Those represent the monitoring stations, about 45 in all in Long Island Sound. But the orange and yellow represent concentrations then between 3.5 milligrams per liter and 2 milligrams per liter. Those are also concentrations that clearly would be of concern. Anything less than the standard, which is 4.8 milligrams per liter, or in this case the EPA criteria for chronic effects is shown in the green color. So you can see up to half of Long Island Sound has conditions that can clearly would be defined as hypoxia, less than 3 milligrams per liter, and up to two-thirds can have levels that could result in at least some chronic effects on living resources. Let me go on to slide number 25. We have a graph of total nitrogen loads to Long Island Sound. The point I really want to make here is two things. One is that the natural load of nitrogen, which is shown in that far right bar called pre-colonial, is much lower than the amount of nitrogen that Long Island Sound is currently receiving from the watershed through runoff or through direct point sources or indirect point sources. In fact, we've probably enriched the load of nitrogen by about tenfold to Long Island Sound. I'm focusing on nitrogen because in the Long Island Sound, that's the nutrient that is most limiting phytoplankton production and most directly related to eutrophication of the system and ultimately low dissolved oxygen concentrations. The second point I would make is that the, I guess that's a teal colored, for those of you that are colorblind, I'll point out the New York and Connecticut point sources. Those represent sewage treatment plants. Those are the ones, the two bars to the left. We are a point source dominated system. In many systems now, we like to talk about polluted runoff being the remaining problem of concern. Well, in Long Island Sound, that's not necessarily the case. Certainly, polluted runoff is a problem and contributes to a lot of problems, water quality impairments. But point source wastewater discharges are the dominant source of nitrogen to Long Island Sound, and so certainly it lends itself to a TMDL approach to try to control those sources of nutrients. Let's go on to slide number 26. I want to just talk briefly about a little bit about what we know, how the system has changed. This graphic is showing organic carbon content in the sediments of Long Island Sound. On the x-axis is a time scale going up to from 1100 up to current conditions. And this graphic is obtained from sediment cores where the organic carbon content is measured, and then the sediment is aged using a variety of techniques to be able to identify then the carbon content going back in time through the sediment cores. And what we've seen is that the organic carbon content has just about doubled in Long Island Sound. You can see a spike around 1700s that would relate to the development of the watershed, the initial colonization of the area, clear cutting of forests. And then we can see, obviously, in more recent times, the big spike relating to really large-scale population growth and the industrial age in the region. While I'm showing organic carbon, we also, it's also been documented that biogenic silica has shown the same pattern. That would be from diatoms, the shells of diatoms, which is a type of marine plant, a phytoplankton, that is responsible for most of the primary production in Long Island Sound. And that also has increased in the sediments, showing that clearly this link in, this increase in nutrient load that I talked about in the slide earlier has resulted in increased primary production in the sound. That's resulted in increased organic matter that is reaching the sediments, being buried in the sediments, but is also being burned off in the sediments and consuming oxygen. The shells of foraminifera, which is an animal that feeds on diatoms, has also increased in the sediments. So we can see these changes reverberating through the food web. Let me go on to slide number 27. I've talked about some of the impacts in dissolved oxygen conditions, but there are other impacts that are expressed through this increased eutrophication in Long Island Sound. Certainly eelgrass has declined from historic range in the sound. That top map shows just points where there was some historical account of eelgrass in embayments or harbors around Long Island Sound. The important point is that it extended throughout its length, right on from the easternmost parts of the sound right up through to the west. The western area of the sound, you saw that in the hypoxia contour map, is the most heavily impacted. It's the area of both greatest population and also because of increased stratification of the water column in that area, most susceptible to eutrophication and other water quality problems. The bottom map shows the current eelgrass distribution in orange, and it is limited only to the far eastern part of Long Island Sound. So we've lost eelgrass as a viable habitat, mainly because of impaired water clarity. It will no longer support eelgrass. Let's go on to slide number 28. So we see these impairments, and the big question is, well, what do we do now? Let's go on to 29. Dialing over this already, certainly the Clean Water Act lays out an approach. If you have water quality limited waters, you're supposed to identify them, identify allowable pollutant loads that would allow us to attain the desired water quality, and then implement it through tools within the Clean Water Act, using standards criteria, classification system, implementing through regulations, permits, watershed management planning as well. Certainly that's an approach to doing it. Let's go on to slide number 30. The challenge, I often refer to it as the Clean Water Act versus Clean Water Acting. And we know what we've described, and certainly what is outlined in TMDL guidance is what is on the left-hand column. You do water quality assessments. You then list waters that are not attaining water quality. You develop the TMDLs, and you implement through permits and other Clean Water Act programs. That is not really the same as an approach that we also laud and support, which is watershed-based planning and implementation, which is takes a community-based focus, which often starts with the question that Gene from Pennsylvania asked, which is how do we set realistic goals? It includes visioning, consensus building, tries to integrate a whole host of different social objectives with environmental and economic objectives, tries to be flexible and incorporate adaptive management. So we have these two approaches. The challenge that I see and that certainly we face in Long Island Sound, and I think most people face, is how to integrate these two approaches, how to best use the tools available in the Clean Water Act, but also use some of the advantages of a community-based, watershed-based program. I'm going to go on to slide 31. I'm going to talk briefly about some of the challenges, specific challenges we have in Long Island Sound. Dal talked a little bit about the scale differences among many of the estuary programs. Certainly that's the case in Long Island Sound. We have a number of different scales that we need to think about even with our own program. Certainly we have the direct coastal development around Long Island Sound involving New York and Connecticut. But we also have a watershed that extends through Massachusetts, includes parts of Vermont and New Hampshire that drain to the Connecticut River. We have a little part of Rhode Island as well that drains into Long Island Sound. And if we think of the airshed to Long Island Sound, well, now we can go up to about 12 states. But all of these scales need to be certainly considered in developing a TMDL, integrating pollutant sources, control potential from all of these different sources. Many of them are not directly involved within the program. Let me go on to slide 32. There certainly are a number of other issues in terms of how to approach the TMDL. Some of the fundamental ones that we had to deal with were, could we attain water quality standards? That was sort of the first question. The water quality standards at the time when the program first initiated assessments, it was prior to EPA's marine DO criteria that had been issued for at least for the North Atlantic coastal region. So there were some fundamental questions about the technical basis for the current DO standards, which would never go below 5 milligrams per liter in Connecticut waters and never go, in New York waters and never go below 6 milligrams per liter in Connecticut waters. So it's the question about affordability, certainly the cost of upgrading wastewater treatment plants, for nitrogen removal was paramount concern. There were equity issues, again, because of the size of the watershed. We had to make it in its sort of crudest description. It was New York City versus the Connecticut River. Was it the mass of people in New York City that were providing all the nutrients, or was it the flow from the Connecticut River, which provides 70% of the fresh water to Long Island Sound, the Connecticut River being out in the eastern part of the basin? And certainly questions with managing many of the out-of-basin loads, atmospheric deposition being the most extreme example. Let's go on to slide 33. One approach that we took was to develop numerical models, both the water quality and hydrodynamic models, that enabled us to at least assess the effect of carbon and nitrogen inputs on the dissolved oxygen balance, and to perform a number of what-if scenarios to try to understand at least the response, the potential response to the system from controlling nitrogen, phosphorus, or carbon, and help support the development, or at least the technical basis for development of the TMDL. Let me go on to slide 34. I'm going to simplify that transition from slide 33 to 34 jumps over about 10 years of monitoring, modeling, assessments, back and forth discussions, and I'm going to lead us right now to the magical place where the TMDL was approved. So there'll be another talk in terms of the development of the TMDL. We ultimately came down to the conclusion of the target of setting a 58.5% reduction goal for nitrogen from sources in Connecticut and New York. That was broken into a 10% reduction to nitrogen runoff from urban and agricultural land covers in the watershed, and a balance of nitrogen reduction then from point sources that came out to 64% reduction in Connecticut, 59% in New York. And certainly we looked at the potential benefits in terms of improved water quality through water quality modeling, and related that to the BO criteria to try to understand the potential impacts. And the predicted improvements would be very significant. Let's go on to slide 35. This really gets to the heart of it. Now, we had a TMDL. There are some key implementation issues. What is the best approach for trying to implement the 58.5% reduction? One challenge is that we had developed cost estimates by all the dischargers for what it would cost to upgrade their wastewater treatment plants. Many of those estimates varied, so there was not agreement as to which dischargers would be the most cost-effective ones to target. There were also a lack of incentives for dischargers to initiate actions. Gary Johnson will talk about this in detail with the Connecticut Trading Program, disagreements over how to allocate that 58.5% reduction. There's the inertia against the collaboration, trying to get different discharges, different regions to work together to achieve reductions, and also the challenge of achieving really such large-scale reductions. We knew that the financing and the ability to construct facilities would require activity over a 15-year period. So we set that reduction goal to be phased in over 15 years. Let's go on to slide 36. I'll give some examples. There are 108 point source discharges in just New York and Connecticut alone that affect Long Island Sound. That map just shows you their distribution. The largest ones are in New York City, so there's a mix of both very large discharges and very small ones. Let me go on to slide 37. The analysis that we undertook was to understand the capital cost of upgrading all of those 108 facilities and compare that to the amount of nitrogen reduction they could achieve. We very simply looked at the range of the options for upgrades, both low-level, moderate-level, and high-level removals of nitrogen, looked at the cost of each of those, and then just plotted those that were most cost-effective first, and you get this kind of cost curve. The big message from this is that if we did a limit of technology requirement, the cost would be up to around $2.5 billion. But yet there was an option if we only required about 80% basin-wide of that limit of technology option, the cost would only be around $650-700 million. So for we could get 80% of the potential nitrogen removal for only 40-30% of the cost. So we did consider cost and tried to target that level. That's where that 58.5% reduction level came from in the TMDL. The challenge then is how to actually have implementation also follow a cost-effective approach, and how could we build that into the regulatory system and the permitting system so that we could actually implement cost-effective strategies and not just predict that there was a potential or there was one cost-effective option among many that were out there. Let's go on to slide number 38. The solution that we came upon that worked for this region was, again, to set the reduction target as a 15-year goal that would be phased in. We did not try to, we did not set wastewater allocations, load allocations that were specific for, or that varied for each wastewater treatment plant. We allocated equal reductions by management zone, so everyone got a 58.5% reduction target. And then the key thing is we allowed flexibility and built into the TMDL some of the means to provide flexibility to allow variable implementation so that some wastewater treatment plants could achieve greater than the 58.5% level and other wastewater treatment plants could achieve a lower level of reduction. Again, as long as we were meeting our watershed-wide goals. There are two ways this was done. It's done differently in both states. In New York, it's done by a bubble permit, and in Connecticut, it's done by a general permit. Let's go on to slide 39. One of the key elements in the TMDL that helps support this trading is that we had trading ratios incorporated right into the TMDL. And these ratios were calculations of the relative impact of a pound of nitrogen from a particular geographic area on, in this case, dissolved oxygen, water quality in Long Island Sound. And it considered both the watershed attenuation and delivery to Long Island Sound. And these were derived from both water quality modeling and watershed calculations. Let's go on to slide 40. I'll show you a little bit how it would work. This map shows the different management zones that were developed. We have 11 land-based management zones. Number 12 is Long Island Sound itself. The numbers in the little blue boxes are the trading ratios for each zone. So each zone got its own trading ratio. Let's go on to slide 41. I'll show you how it would work. Let's say there's 100 pounds of nitrogen generated in the northeastern portion of Connecticut. We could calculate that only 80 pounds of that would make it through to Long Island Sound. Some of that, 20 pounds, would be attenuated within the watershed, within stream flow or groundwater flow to Long Island Sound. And of that 80 pounds entering eastern Long Island Sound, it would have only a impact of 20 pounds. That is, through mixing processes, much of that nitrogen might exit out into the open waters or not contribute to production that would impact hypoxia in the hot spots in Long Island Sound. Meanwhile, if we took the other example and looked at 100 pounds of nitrogen generated by a discharger in southwest Connecticut, we'd estimate that the full impact of those 100 pounds would be observed in Long Island Sound. So the trading ratio there would be 5-1 in this case, that a pound removed by that southwestern discharger would have 5 times the impact of a pound removed in the northeast portion of the sound. So on to slide 42, I'm going to talk briefly about the permitting approach in New York, and again, I'll leave it to Gary Johnson to go into detail about Connecticut. New York has used what we call bubble permits. What that does is take all the discharges within one of those management zones. They get a permit where there's an aggregate annual limit for all the point sources within that zone. As long as the discharges from that zone are meeting their aggregate limit, they're considered to be in compliance. If they don't meet the aggregate limit, then the individual limits for that individual discharger would come into play for compliance purposes. What this does is twofold. One, it encourages facilities, the state, to work with facilities within that region to try to work together to identify the most cost-effective technologies. For an example, in Westchester County of New York, the county operates 4 wastewater treatment plants. Well, by having an aggregate limit, rather than them looking at meeting a 58.5% reduction for each plant, they can look at them in total and say, what's the most cost-effective way for meeting these goals? They may want to invest more money. It may be less expensive for them to invest more money in 1 or 2 plants than to try to invest equally in each plant. The second thing it does is allow reallocation among management zones. So again, there can be trades between one zone and another. Let's go to slide 43. I'll give an example. In New York City, they actually have 2 management zones. They have a trading ratio between those 2 zones. New York City has looked at achieving greater reductions at their management zone that has a greater impact on water quality in Long Island Sound. So what they'll do there is exceed the 58.5% reduction, do less at a management zone that has less of an impact on Long Island Sound. By doing so, their own estimates are they could save $600 million in terms of some of the construction upgrade costs. Just to give you an example, some of these wastewater treatment plants that we're talking about are up to 300 million gallons per day, so very large facilities, 6 facilities overall discharging 1 billion gallons per day. So obviously upgrades to these facilities are enormous investments in time and capital. And if there are any opportunities to obtain water quality goals, and that's the key here, is that they still would have to achieve reductions consistent with the water quality improvement objectives, but can do it in a way that can save them money, then that's certainly a win for everyone. Let's go to slide 44. This is my one slide on the Connecticut program, and I'll only say that in Connecticut, they have formed a more formal trading program passed through legislation, and again, Gary will go through that in detail. Let me transition now to the last point that I wanted to make, which was progress. So we have this program, the TMDL, and the approach. Are we seeing some benefits? What this chart shows is total nitrogen from wastewater treatment plants discharging to the Sound from 1994 to 2005. You can see we're at a peak discharge in 1994. Reductions started to be phased in with upgrades to treatment plants. We've had actually a little bump up from 2003 to 2004. In some ways, that is a good thing. What it reflects is that some of the wastewater treatment plants that had implemented nitrogen removal at their facilities on an interim basis, those interim upgrades have been taken offline because they're being reconstructed for state-of-the-art nitrogen removal. So we do expect to see a bump upward in the next couple of years as plants are taking tanks out of service, going offline, but through for the expected purpose of redesign and reconstruction to enable them to achieve state-of-the-art nitrogen reduction levels. So we have, though, overall achieved approximately about a 25% reduction in the point source load to Long Island Sound. So to slide 46, certainly as with every system, point sources are not the only source of nutrients. It's true for Long Island Sound, while they are a dominant source. This slide was showing nitrogen from combined point sources and the coastal, direct coastal runoff, and from riverine runoff into the Sound, a major tributary. And this, of course, shows the variability in loadings to Long Island Sound related to rainfall primarily. And obviously, we hope as we continue to track this to see some reductions as well based on land management activities. Land management activities are not the obviously not the focus of this talk, but certainly there's concerted efforts in that area as well. Let me go on to slide number 47. I do want to talk briefly, and this actually relates to presentation made last week on the webcast. If any of you saw the NEMO telecast, we've actually worked with their group on trying to track changes in land cover and impervious surface in the region of Long Island Sound. It gives us, obviously, a feel for how development, continued development pressures in the watershed may affect stressors and nutrient loads to the Sound. The two things I'd want to point out, if you look by those red arrows, the percent of land cover that is defined as developed has increased from 18% in 1985 to 21% in 2002, and that's mainly at the expense of forest cover, which has decreased from 62% down to 57%. The map that you see to the left is the composite satellite image of those different land covers within the New York and Connecticut portions of the watershed. So certainly we see continued pressure from watershed development on nutrient loadings and other pollutant sources. Let's go to slide 48, another way of looking at those changes. Here we're just comparing the percent increase in population versus the percent increase in development. We're breaking it out into different portions of the watershed: Connecticut, Long Island, New York City, Westchester, and then all of the New York and Connecticut portions of the watershed. The main point I'd make, and it's best illustrated in the Connecticut example, is that the increase in development has far outpaced the increase in population. And what that shows is that we continue to develop at a rate that is using up the land. We saw the decrease in that forested land cover, so it suggests a continued sprawl development We'd suspect if it was infill development, redevelopment of urban areas, that you'd get more of an increase in population relative to the change in developed land covers. Let's go to slide 49. Here I'm showing the trends in dissolved oxygen. The bars are the area of hypoxia defined as less than 3 milligrams per liter. The yellow line is the duration of hypoxia in days. This is trends monitored Long Island Sound from 1987 through the summer of 2006. 2 points. One, this is a very variable system. It will vary depending on weather conditions in the summer. Will depend on conditions that occur throughout the year that could increase both the delivery of nutrients, the setup and persistence of stratification in Long Island Sound. But certainly, we expect, as we continue to see nitrogen reductions, to continue this monitoring and hope to see response to the system. There's suggestion here that we're seeing a slight long-term reduction in both the area and duration of hypoxia, but obviously there's a lot of year-to-year variability. Let me go to the last slide. I'm just going to try to sum up some of the changes that we've seen in the system. Total nitrogen load, the trend is down by 28%, so we have a decreasing trend in total nitrogen load to Long Island Sound. We have a decrease of about 14% in surface total nitrogen concentration. We've got observing a decrease of 24% in the bottom total nitrogen concentration. We've observed a 16% reduction in surface chlorophyll A, and we've seen an increase in 9% of bottom dissolved oxygen. So obviously that's the cascade, the connection that we're looking to see through wastewater treatment upgrades, through non-point source controls. We want to get a reduction in nitrogen loads to the sound, expect to see it observed in lower concentrations that will reduce phytoplankton production and ultimately improve dissolved oxygen conditions. Last slide is just to sum up really my point of view in terms of the lesson, is that we really do need to have flexibility in how we try to pursue attainment of water quality objectives. Certainly, we need to focus on the outcome, build support for that outcome. Strong public support is critical. We need to really think about how to develop practical solutions that can be supported at the state level, the local level. We need to think about how financing is going to come together with the planned reductions, and obviously we need to be able to have a active monitoring and assessment program to relate progress to the program back to the public and ourselves, and recheck and rethink our approaches. With that, I'll stop and see if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mark. We're going to break now for some questions. First of all, I'm going to take the online questions, and again, you're welcome to continue submitting those online. First question that we have from Corn in New Bedford, Massachusetts is, does EPA have a legal mechanism to enforce state TMDLs? If so, what is that mechanism, and if not, why not? Mark? Can you want to address that?
Well, there's probably a couple of ways to look at it. I think maybe the first question is, if there is a TMDL developed, does EPA have a mechanism to enforce it? Certainly, if as part of a TMDL there are controls on point sources, EPA does have authority within the Clean Water Act to enforce those point source limits. Now, that's not necessarily an easy process. many of the states are delegated the pollutant discharge elimination system, the permitting program. One option is the EPA to take back that program. That doesn't work very well. But certainly, you know, EPA can work to enforce permits to make sure that they're consistent with, obviously, the TMDLs, and that those TMDLs are designed to help achieve water quality standards. It's a harder question when we're talking about how to implement TMDLs that rely primarily on non-point source load reductions, where there is not necessarily a regulatory tool within the Clean Water Act that EPA can enforce. You know, certainly I think EPA can take an active role in trying to encourage that implementation, but it's the challenge that everyone has, and that in many cases neither do the states have the ability to enforce some of those reductions. Another, and this may be related to your question, is what if does EPA have the authority to enforce development of a TMDL? So if one has not been developed. Certainly, the Clean Water Act says EPA is supposed to review and approve TMDLs, and if a state doesn't modify the TMDLs, EPA has the recourse of developing it on its own. That approach is one that probably is not practical on any large scale in terms of resources. So the approach has been for EPA to collaborate with the states and others to try to develop TMDL. That's certainly my take on it.
Okay, thanks, Mark. I think in the interest of time, we're going to phone lines and I'll let people ask any specific questions they have of Mark. Questions on the phones?
My name is Mary Therese Gookin with Gookin Technical Target Marketing, and since you've been experiencing some significant success in reduction in the estuary program, do you know if EPA is making any movement towards some inland watershed trading programs in light of this success?
Well, Dal, I don't know if you want to comment on that. Certainly EPA's encouraging trading throughout the country. It's certainly not focused on the estuary program. The one key element to that is that any water quality trading really requires that there be a good base of data to support those trades. And the estuary programs, by their nature, often have done the background work that's necessary to support water quality trading.
There are a number of other areas around the country, interior. Coastal areas.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please, because there were a lot of beeps.
Yes, there are other areas around the country that are pursuing trading. As Mark indicated, it's oftentimes you need the source of information and good quality data to trading. There are other areas around the country that are working on that, and I don't have the specific reference, but I know that there's an EPA website that deals with some of the trading issues.
Right. Well, with the 28 national estuary programs, I know that the Long Island Sound has a lot of, reason to have successful trading with all of the point sources, but are there other estuaries where more aggressive trading is being looked at because the layout might be ideal?
I'm trying to think of an example right now. The Tampa Bay situation might
trading going on, but it also involves a lot of voluntary activities, too, where in Tampa they're concerned about the ultimate goal is restoration of seagrasses to the 1950 level, but seagrasses are impacted by water clarity, which deals with too much nitrogen. So they're not only trying to reduce the current amount of nitrogen, but also to help to achieve the...
Do we still have a connection?
Yes, we should be there. Everybody there? Okay, thank you, Daryl and Mark. Before continuing with today's presentation, I want you all to turn to slide number 53. Just a quick word about our next webcast. We all know there is power in information, but a critical step is that you have to be able to get that information. EPA collects and stores information on various aspects of the nation's water bodies and databases, but surprisingly, many people aren't aware how to take advantage of these tools that EPA has made available to anyone with Internet access. They can query it, they can access the information, map it, and use the information. So we urge you to tune in next month to get the power of information by learning how to query and get reports on some key EPA water-related databases, such as our Water Quality Standards database, the 303 listed impaired waters, assessed waters, STORE, which is our Water Quality Monitoring database, and discharge monitoring reports from permitted discharges. This session will also cover the interface of an online mapping application, EnviroMapper, for water, and other resources for watershed-related networking, including BMPs to minimize non-source land-based pollution and self-paced training on watershed topics and lots more. So please tell your friends and attend this informative webcast on March 28th. Registration will open on March 19th on the Watershed Academy website. As usual, visit our website at www.epa.gov/watershed webcast, that's one word, to register at that time. So let's continue with our webcast. Gary Johnson from Connecticut's DEP is our next speaker. Gary?
Thank you, Ann. Hopefully everybody hears me now.
Yes.
Please. Good. I'm going to skip over my first slide after the introduction because Mark had done a good job of explaining the problem and the location of Long Island Sound and get into a little bit of the mechanics of how our trading program works and where we are in it. Our initial TMDL starting point, which our TMDL, as Mark said earlier, was completed and approved by EPA, I believe, in April of 2001. We initiated, the legislature gave us approval in 2002 to develop a trading program and general permit. So we kicked off our program in January of 2002, and we're just entering our sixth year of trading now in Connecticut. But our initial starting point was about 50,000 pounds, 48,708 from our point sources, or a little over 400 million gallons a day of wastewater discharge. We're obviously a bit smaller than New York City, but still we have 79 facilities that are part of our program. And I'll be jumping right now to slide number 57, which then will give the ending point of the program of about 17,774 pounds. Now, if you do the math on that quickly, you'll find out that it's a little more than 58.5%, which is what the TMDL had for the entire Long Island Sound Basin. What we did in Connecticut, because we are so point source driven, is we bumped that number up to about 64% reduction that we are requiring out of our 79 municipal wastewater treatment facilities in the program. So, in other words, we had to get by 2014 down to a little under 18,000 pounds of total nitrogen discharged. Moving on to slide 58, how are we going to accomplish this with 79 facilities? The traditional way would be to go out and issue orders to all 79 facilities and get them into a schedule, and it would be their individual problems to come up with a solution. They would all be going out hiring consultants or hiring attorneys probably to fight us. So the options were to go with this traditional program, which you can see in the slide, it would be their permit, their problem, a high cost for compliance because everybody would be building to a very high level of treatment, a high cost for non-compliance because of the litigation that would go on, and it would in all likelihood reward the guy that hung out the longest before he had to do anything. So as an option to that in Connecticut, we developed an alternate trading program on slide 59, in which was the general permit was the heart of the program. We had established loads for everybody, base loads, starting point loads for everybody in the waste load allocation process, and then we put together a trading program with these 79 facilities, all under one general permit. We went out in the fall of 2001 with this draft permit, had a couple days of hearings, but in the end of the day, everybody, all 79 communities, agreed to participate in the program, and unbelievably, all 79 are still participating in the program after five full years. Essentially, it has a lower cost because it allows people to trade where it's to their advantage. It allows people to, in the more significant areas, to build treatment and get rewarded to some degree through the sale of credits, and it provides that incentive. So the program provides a number of benefits, in essence, protects the communities as long as everybody participates in the program. Moving on to slide 60. You'll see the trading zones. Mark talked a little bit earlier about the overall Long Island Sound Basin trading zones. What we did in Connecticut is that we have management zones 1 through 6. We took them and equated the highest in the lower southwestern Connecticut, the Stamford Greenwich area, or if you're looking at it to your lower left-hand side of the map of Connecticut, is the highest value of 1. And that decreases as you get further to the east and further to the northeast to a lowest zone of about 0.14 way up in the far northeastern part of the state. So in other words, if you consider a value of a pound of nitrogen and look at it, you would determine that the most valuable nitrogen, of course, is in that far lower left-hand side and the least valuable way up in the far right, upper right-hand corner. And this sets a value for what kind of plants people will build and how much money they'll invest, because it's obviously cheaper to buy credits in a low EQ zone, and it's more advantageous to sell credits in a higher EQ zone. But obviously, when you look at the benefit you get from a discharge down in that 1-to-1 zone, it's the maximum benefit that one could derive in equalized load. So our program is set up in a general permit table with values for each year, and it's based on an EQ zone of where you're located. And how the trading works, you have a permit setting a permit limit. We have a five-year general permit. We're in the second cycle of that permit now for the next 5 years. And then one has to determine a value of a credit, which I'll talk about in a little bit, and then we go into an execution of trades, which occur on an annual basis. Our program is a fairly rigid program. It's managed by a Nitrogen Credit Exchange Board, which is appointed by the legislature and governor, and it's set up to formulas that are put into the trading statute. Moving on to slide number 62, we'll talk a little bit about setting the permit limits. When the program was first put together, the attempt was to put together a program where the buyers and sellers would be equal. Now, in theory, this is beautiful. It's like trying to set a stock price and then actually seeing it come out at the end of the year. It doesn't quite happen that way. There's usually a positive or a negative cash flow at the end of each year. But if you look at here, you have a project end of pipe load from each POTW in year one of the permit period. You set that value as the starting load from each of the 79 towns. You have an equalized factor, which comes in, as we showed in that earlier map, of where you're located within the state as to what your EQ factor will be. You sum the equalized loads statewide and set the permit limit for each POTW on assigned fair share percentage of allocation on a statewide load. Now, we set this original in the waste load, in the waste load allocation by their 3-year average flows from the years 1997, 98, and 99 times a statewide average discharge of nitrogen that was occurring at the beginning of the program, which was about 15.5 milligrams per liter. So the load was set by their flow over that 3-year period because that represented an average of a high, a low, and a medium year of flow, and multiplying that times 15.5 milligrams per liter, and you come up with a mass-based load of nitrogen for each facility at a starting point. And then you set the permit program out for that 5-year period based on what we thought were going to be planned completed projects. One thing we always have to do with our 79 facilities is be looking 3 to 5 years ahead to see which projects are going to be moving forward, because it generally takes 3 to 4 years to plan, design, and build a medium-sized project, and can take up to 6 years to complete construction of a large project. And then we check our progress to see how we're moving along to meeting the 2014 removal goal for the TMDL. Let's move on to slide number 63. The value of a credit. What is the value of a credit? The value of a credit is the cost of nitrogen treatment divided by the pounds of nitrogen removed. Now, we have two values that we look at. We look at the operating cost of these facilities to remove nitrogen, what it actually costs them to operate for electricity, labor, chemicals, and then we look at the capital cost of what it costs to build the facility. And if we move on to 64, we can see a little bit, as I'll finish up, let me get back to 64 here, I jumped ahead. The capital cost is the annual cost of the amount of Clean Water Fund loan for repayment. What we have in Connecticut is most of these projects are funded through our Connecticut Clean Water Fund, which is our state revolving loan fund plus a grant. And the grants range anywhere from 20% to 30% of the capital cost of a treatment plant. And we calculate that capital cost in the program for the communities for trading purposes as that loan repayment. It's kind of like what your mortgage payment would be, and it's based on our low-interest loans, which run for about $1 million borrowed, $61,160. The second phase, or second part of the cost of the credit, is the operation maintenance cost. We go out and we survey all of our treatment facilities each year and look at a detailed operating cost for those facilities. And that is based on what it costs to operate them from electricity, chemicals, and labor. Put the two of them together, and that comes up with the operation and maintenance cost. Now, that cost in the first year of the program, 2002, was $1.65, and in the most recent year we just completed, 2006, is $3.40. And that is projected to increase each year in a range of about 75 cents per year out for the next 5 years. And some of those variables are uncertain variables, namely the cost of fuels, the cost of electricity, which in the case of Connecticut, as a deregulated electric state, we saw some facilities go up 30% to 40% in their electric use costs per year, which obviously had an effect on chemical costs, on electric motors. The second most variable cost is some of our plants that are using now methanol as a denitrification chemical. That cost has varied significantly from year to year, too. So those two costs come up with the O&M cost. Capital costs make the cost of the credit, which is $3.40 per equalized pound removed in the year 2006. And to give you a little idea of what that credit cost relates to people on the buying and selling, the largest, for 2006, the largest purchaser of credits was the Hartford Metropolitan District plant, which is about a 60 million gallon a day plant, is paying about $1 million in purchase credits for 2006. And the largest receiver of selling credits is the Bridgeport, one of the Bridgeport treatment plants, which will get back about $360,000 a year through the selling credits for 2006. If we go on to slide number 65, we can see where we are progress-wise from 2000 to 2005 going into 2006. I didn't have the final amount here for 2006 when I put this presentation together, but where we are in Connecticut right now is we're about 50% to our ultimate 2014 requirement. So we're a little ahead of the overall program that Mark had, I believe, had 28% reduction overall from all sources. And where we are on a milligram per liter strength of discharge, we started out at 15.5, and we're a little bit under 10 overall across the board now. But we still have a lot of work to go. Obviously, the next 8 years will be the harder nitrogen to remove, the more significant projects, and one of the keys to our program is always trying to be 3 to 5 years ahead of where we are today so that we hopefully can get there in the right schedule. Moving on to slide number 66, what we've done today, we have a total of 37 nitrogen removal projects that have been completed in Connecticut. Out of those 79 facilities, 37 of them have actually gone ahead and completed. We've probably at this time now have about 10 that are either in design or construction, additional to those. And these projects have ranged all the way across the board, from the simplest low-cost retrofits to full facility reconstruction. I think our lowest cost project was probably in the range of a couple $100,000 to our most significant, most expensive project was about a little over $100 million. And that $100 million project, about $59 million, as you can see here, was for nitrogen removal. The balance of that $104 million project was for other treatment improvements. A number of these facilities, as they get into full-scale rebuilds, will also be looking at odor control and other instrumentation improvements across the board in the facility. To date, the department has expended over $150 million from our State Clean Water Funds program in the form of grants for nitrogen removal. And we'll move on to number 67. A couple of examples of different projects that we've taken on over the years. The picture is of the New Haven, Connecticut wastewater treatment facility. It's about a 40 million gallon a day treatment facility. And this was done as a earlier retrofit where they didn't actually add tankage. They modified existing tankage at that facility for an approximate cost of $8.2 million. And it has served very well since it went online in, I think, 1997. And has reduced nitrogen consistently to a little under 7 milligrams per liter. However, that won't make the long-term 2014 nitrogen number. And this, as we move on to slide number 68, I've got an overlay of the years 2002 through 2005 performance of the facility. And as you can see, the load and discharges in pounds per day. The red line that you see all the way across is the 2014, the multicolored lines each going down from the blue to the pink to the green to the teal color is each year's limit. And as we can see, as we get a little further out with a facility like New Haven, we see some variability that's occurred, a lot of it to wet weather and cold weather operations. New Haven is a CSO community, so we certainly see some variability that occurs, and in fact, at some point in the next 5 years, New Haven will probably be building additional tankage, but the trading program has certainly allowed them to move forward in the first 5 or 6 years of the program by being able to sell credits. And that's one of the beauties of the program. It allows flexibility for a community to make decisions over the long period of time. We'll go on to slide number 69. Other projects that have required a full reconstruction. This is the town of Brantford facility, as you can see, located next to a very nice marina. This was a full rebuild that occurred for a cost of about $21 million. It's designed to operate below the TMDL number of 5.6 milligrams per liter to an average load of less than 4 milligrams per liter, which would be what we consider in our area, the limit of technology. And again, if we go on to slide 70, we can see this 5 million gallon a day facility, how it's been running since its startup in 2002. And with the exception of a couple of excursions that occurred, one in 2002 and one in 2004, has stayed pretty much below the 2014 limit, and the facility actually does have a capability, if it's creeping up, to add additional chemical methanol to help with denitrification. Though it's designed into the facility, they haven't had to use it yet as a cost-saving measure, even though they're staying well below that number. But once they get up above it, they can use it to give them a safety factor for more nitrogen to be removed. Moving on to slide 71, one of the beauties of our trading program has been that it has allowed an innovation that we probably wouldn't have seen under a traditional program, because typically under a traditional NPDES permit and then an administrative or consent order to a community would bring on a consultant who would then design a system that would probably operate at the lowest level all the time with a huge safety factor that would probably cost 2 to 3 times more than what was really necessary to do the job. So the state could not afford to probably spend the amount of money that would be necessary to take all 79 facilities and make them limited technology facilities. So some of the interesting things we've seen, this particular picture is a what we call IFAS media, integrated fixed film activated sludge media, which actually allows more organisms to grow on this media and thus put more treatment into a given existing tank. They were able to operate these programs as energy-saving programs, which in some cases they wouldn't have been able to do under a traditional approach. Again, the next picture on 72 will show the tank actually operating with the media in it. We can't see it. I'm going to move ahead to 73, where you'll actually see what that media looks like when the tank is drained down. As you can see, it's set in racks, and it's allowed this particular facility to save a considerable amount of money because they were located in the lower EQ zone. This is the town of Windsor Locks, to move ahead with a program that will get them down to about 8 milligrams per liter, but at probably one quarter the cost it would have been to rebuild the facility. If we move on to slide 74, a little bit of a retrofit cost scenario is where we are for our smaller plants in the 1 to 3 million gallon a day size. The typical cost for these retrofit programs, that's not pouring new concrete, utilizing existing tankage, was about $500,000 per million gallons of treatment capacity. The larger plants, the 5 to 10s and above, actually came out a little less in the $160,000 per MGD capacity for retrofit costs. On the other hand, the full rebuild costs were considerably higher than that. If we move on to 75, one of the things we've done in Connecticut as part of our program is we've asked all of our 79 municipalities, which I think we're up to about 76 now, have actually completed a facility study for nitrogen removal as the first step to assessing their needs. And these studies have been done over a period of time of 6 months to up to a year. And one of the things that's really saved a lot of time is the use of computer simulation models, which we required as part of our study scope in Connecticut. Really can do a lot of what-if scenarios, look at what these plants can do with an existing tankage, and even project what would be needed for future treatment capacity at these facilities. So the use of these models has really given us a good tool to work with across the state. And in closing, I have a slide number 76, which just is gives you a picture of Connecticut. The red dots that you see on the slide, scattered around mostly in the left to lower left hand side of the state, are the highest level treatment facilities, the ones that achieve that TMDL. And the yellow dots are projects that were of an interim basis, which got down to about 8 milligrams per liter. But we've had a lot of great success, and the most important thing in closing that's so important is that we've kept the 79 towns all working. They've all bought the credits, certainly when they needed to. They've moved projects forward where they've needed to, and we've yet to have to issue a consent or administrative order to anyone to build new systems. In fact, one of the problems we have in Connecticut right now is that we have more demand for projects moving forward than we have funds within our Clean Water Fund, and hopefully the legislature in this next budget session will increase the funding to our program so that we can reach all those that want to move ahead. A number of communities have actually gone out on their own and spent, in some cases, $3 or $4 million to design facilities, so they're they're ready to move ahead. So we've seen a tremendous amount of cooperation within our municipalities and a lot of enthusiasm of the operators that run these facilities to run them at the best of their capability. And with that, I'll take questions.
Thanks, Gary. We do have a few minutes to answer some additional questions, but first of all, I'm going to ask you to move to slide number 78. Let me draw your attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information. If you're online, you can simply click on the home icon button at the top of your screen, and you'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has the speaker's email addresses and phone numbers. On the left-hand sidebar is the links button, which has additional resources identified by today's speakers, and that's on slide number 78 also. Also on the left-hand sidebar is the feedback button. Please consider submitting online feedback form as we do consider your comments as we work to improve our webcast. So now we have time for some additional questions. First of all, I'm going to take some of the excellent questions that we've received online. And perhaps this is one, Gary, you can help answer. The first question from Ted in Canada, in Calgary, is, when two facilities buy, sell, or trade credits, it appears that your program decides and prescribes what the cost will be for these credits. If this understanding of the process is correct, have you considered the alternative practice of letting the buyers and seller negotiate the price among themselves, including the possibility of buying and selling options to trade, such as when loads are higher or lower than predicted?
The program in Connecticut, when we originally looked at crafting a trading program, we did look at the open market or ability to trade, with anybody for any value. And one of the issues that pushed us to this more structured program where everybody has to trade through the exchange was due to the fact of the demographics of the state. Generally, the richer, wealthier towns are the towns to the southwestern part of the state, which had made the improvement, which would be receiving money, and to the north and eastern part of the state, the poorer towns, which would be buying the credits. And there was a lot of feeling of getting a fair deal in the program, and I think that pushed the legislature to craft a program where you would have an exchange with the representation from small communities and large communities and buyers and sellers across the board so that everybody would be given a fair approach. It's, there's been a number of times we've been asked that question, would a free market approach have worked? And perhaps it would have, but it also could have left some people out sitting on the outside. This way we've managed to keep them all participating in the program.
Okay, thanks, Gary. Another question here that perhaps Gary or Mark want to address. Did the Long Island Sound TMDL consider growth in setting allocations and load reduction goals? This is from Andrew in Oklahoma City.
I can answer for Connecticut. Connecticut is a statewide, when we looked at our, when I said flows and loads of back in the late 1990s, we were looking at a fairly stable, relatively low growth statewide, although we had certain pockets of the state that had accelerated growth. But we felt overall with our fairly low and stable growth statewide that we could manage this through advances in technology. It may tweak us to, instead of the 15.6, somewhere down the line that we might be a little bit less than that, depending if there was a lot of growth. But the beauty of the program is if you're in a community that grows a lot, then you can still buy credits. I don't know if you want to elaborate a little more, Mark, on the bigger picture of the whole Long Island Sound.
Yeah, certainly by its nature, the TMDL is a cap on the discharge. We only considered growth in the extent, as Gary had mentioned, we did some modeling scenarios with projected growth, but the key really comes back to the implementation side, that in planning facility upgrades and what would be necessary to achieve that cap on reduction, certainly community growth in communities, population increases would need to be considered in planning the capacity of facilities and planning their long-term viability of meeting some of their waste load allocations.
Okay, thank you. We have another question from Eladora in Kansas City, Kansas. And the question is, where did your population and development data originate from?
Is this for specifically for Connecticut?
Well, you could answer for Connecticut.
Certainly we had a pretty good data as far as flows and loads from our treatment facilities. As part of their existing MPDS permit program, certainly they've all been monitoring flows for as long as there's been an MPDS permit program. We have, flow checks and balances to make sure what they were projecting was accurate data. We had a number of years of monitoring data from these facilities, so that combined gave us a good opportunity of what they were discharging. As far as purely population, it's like anything else. It comes through census, and our Connecticut Office of Policy and Management puts out census projection data for all of our communities.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask one more question that we received from William in Edgemont, Pennsylvania. The question is regarding personal care products and prescription drugs that are flushed into sewer systems and through wastewater treatment plants. What steps can be taken on a local level to help mitigate the discharge of these items into the environment?
I don't know. That's a difficult question because it comes down to in many cases, we're not going to control these products, or at least it would be difficult to control these products in terms of their use. They will ultimately make their way, whether it's septic systems or systems that are sewered, into wastewater discharges. And then the question is whether there are any methods available on the treatment side to try to remove some of those products. And Gary, you may better be able to answer that. I tend to think that would be an enormous challenge.
Yeah, there's a lot of research going on right now. The Water Environment Research Foundation has put out some grants for that, and certainly EPA has been involved with that. The traditional treatment plant, as we know it, doesn't do the best job in the world at treating these products, and I think it's going to be a number of years till systems can be made so they could be done on a large-scale basis for that. So. I guess from purely once it enters the sewer system, it's going to see limited treatment by the ability of the organisms within the activated sludge process to assimilate these pharmaceuticals.
Thank you. This is an emerging issue that Daryl mentioned. Apparently, it's going to require some more attention. At this point, I'm going to unmute the phones and ask for any questions from the audience.
I had a question.
Okay.
My name is Stephanie Bertina, and I'm with the U.S. Forest Service. And I just had a question regarding the nitrogen training programs that were discussed, and I was wondering if there was any discussion or consideration to extend those programs to include non-point sources in the trading scenario, where you would do a sort of non-point and point trading system that would include agricultural practice changes and forestry changes as well.
Do you want me to take that from Connecticut?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe you can take it on a bigger scale. Connecticut's program, when it was set up, was first set up as a point source program, but the flexibility is there to add non-point source. One of the key stumbling blocks right now is to, although we have pretty good mapping statewide, to determine usages of land, we would have to bring in 169 partners versus the 79 which we have now, meaning that there's 169 towns in Connecticut. That's probably the stumbling block. One of the things we're looking at and wrestling with is trying to loop it in with our stormwater program and try to develop it in that phase. We have recently just added a couple of industrial partners from a point source into the program, and that's taken quite a bit of time, but I believe it'll get there. It's just a matter of getting the department with the wherewithal to try to bring into a public process 169 towns on their land use and develop a load allocation for those communities.
To add to what Gary said, there was a study conducted in Connecticut trying to look at the potential viability of trade between point and non-point sources conducted by Connecticut DEP, and the conclusion is that at least because we're talking about predominantly urban and suburban land covers and stormwater runoff from those covers, that the cost of controls for many of those sources would be so costly as to make trading between the point and non-point sources prohibitive. Usually we think of the trading, we're thinking of not doing a point source activity because of the lower cost non-point activity, and that may in fact not be the case when we're talking about urban watersheds. But certainly there could be opportunities for that in other systems where we're talking about agricultural or forestry-based sources.
Okay, thank you. We have time for one more question and a quick answer. Arnie.
This is Robin Finch in Boise.
Go ahead.
Yes, Robin Finch in Boise, and I have a question for Mark concerning the cost information and how that affected the choice for the TMDL goal. You indicated that the total cost was $2.5 billion, and the TMDL goal was set so that the cost was about $0.6 billion. Can you explain more on that?
Yeah, it came right from that curve analysis that I showed you, where we just looked at the cost versus nitrogen removal. We also were able to take cost and compare it to dissolved oxygen improvement in Long Island Sound using some of the water poly modeling information. We picked a level of reduction that was not limited technology, but was, if you could think in terms of 5 milligrams per liter throughout the watershed, 5 or 6 milligrams per liter, as opposed to, say, 3 milligrams per liter. So it's just literally doing that kind of cost curve, seeing where you get the knee in the curve, where you get the break in the curve, and using that as a basis for assigning what we felt were feasible and cost-effective levels of treatment.
Thanks, Mark. At this time, I'd like to conclude today's webcast. I'd like to especially thank Dara Round, Mark Tedesco, and Gary Jassen for presenting today. And, of course, thanks to everyone who joined us. A reminder that our next webcast, Key Internet Tools for Watershed Management, is scheduled for March 28th. Registration opens March 19th on the Watershed Academy website at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcast. Finally, be sure to check out EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds homepage at www.epa.gov/OWOW. There you'll find links to information on funding, training, tools, and other technical assistance. One of the features on that page is the Watershed Tool of the Month, and this month's tool is the Community-Based Watershed Management Handbook that Daryl mentioned. That ends our webcast for today. Thank you.